welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, October 5th, 2023. A top UN official says the situation in Sudan is getting out of control.
I have met mothers in Sudan who've told me they don't know where to find the next meal for their children. I've met families sleeping in makeshift shelters, struggling to find food and water, unable to access health care. Their children out of school and the family breadwinners out of work.
And the UN Human Rights Commission says frequent media censorship in South Sudan could affect the outcome of the 2024 general elections.
Journalists, activists, and even ordinary citizens, particularly anybody who dares to discuss issues that the authorities may deem either sensitive or to be critical.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. At least 20 people were killed and scores of others injured on Wednesday morning after a rocket hit a health center in Shamrab neighborhood of Khartoum North. Both Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces trade accusations against each other on the latest incident. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Eyewitnesses say a rocket hit Alhamda Health Center Wednesday, killing 17 people and injuring scores of others. Muhammad Jaffer, a member of an emergency committee in Samrab neighborhood, told VOA earlier today that three people succumbed to their injuries, bringing the death toll to 20.
A bomb fell on the health center that is adjusted to a mosque. The health center has been used to treat sick people and injuries. We lost 17 people on the spot, and the number is expected to increase after three others sustained their injuries, which made the death toll to 20.
Jaffer says the damaged health center is one of the three facilities providing health services to the community in the suburb north of Khartoum, adding that such attacks could amount to crime against humanity. He adds that the attack has affected people in Samrab neighborhood who depend on the facility.
The only ultrasound was damaged and the other two health centers do not have it. The area now has one pharmacy which is already lacking much of the basic medicines.
Brigadier General Nabil Abdullah, a spokesperson of the Sudan Armed Forces, condemned the attack and accused the Rapid Support Forces of targeting the health center. He told Al Hadath TV channel Wednesday that the Sudan Armed Forces respect international humanitarian laws.
These are all crimes that should be recorded in the continued black history of the RSF. Our forces in all its bases within the capital and other towns are fighting the enemy in a professional manner, and we stand ready to defend civilians under any attack.
The Rapid Support Forces denied carrying any attack on the health center. Al-Mak Abu Sultan, the RSF commander in charge of Khartoum North, told VOA via a messaging application earlier today that the Sudan Armed Forces allegedly bombed the health center.
It is our hope that there was a wise leader among the Sudan Armed Forces to stop the ongoing war and stop the bloodshed of the Sudanese youth who are longing for a bright future.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, in Sudan, says since April, it has identified at least 56 attacks on healthcare facilities, resulting in 11 deaths and 38 injuries. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Still on Sudan, a senior UN official today has warned Sudan's population is living on a knife's edge and is at a risk of falling off the cliff if the world does not step up to help them in their hours of need. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN statistics show Sudan has become the world's fastest growing displacement crisis since two rival generals plunged the country into war nearly 6 months ago. Some 5.4 million people are either displaced within Sudan or in neighboring countries as refugees. UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, Clementine Nkweta Salami, says this conflict has upended millions of lives, causing untold suffering and despair.
I have met mothers in Sudan who've told me they don't know where to find the next meal for their children. I've met families sleeping at makeshift shelters, struggling to find food and water, unable to access health care, their children out of school and the family breadwinners out of work.
The outlook is bleak. Nkweta Salami says half of Sudan's 24.7 million people need aid and protection. 70% of all hospitals are not functioning. Sexual and gender-based violence is rampant. Disease and hunger is on the rise. To make matters worse, she says the warring parties do not keep their promises.
4 months ago, the parties meeting in Sudan committed to de-escalate the fighting, minimize civilian harm, and refrain from any disproportionate attacks. But since then, the killing of civilians has continued in Khartoum, in Nuera, in Al-Fasha, and other areas.
She says UN agencies have been able to deliver aid to at least 3.6 million people through two main access points, Port Sudan and from Chad to Darfur. She says more people could be reached if these efforts were not hampered by bureaucratic obstacles, forced checks of humanitarian trucks, and criminal activities such as the looting of trucks by armed groups. Nkweta Salami says without a cessation of hostilities and a permanent ceasefire, the conflict in Sudan risks becoming a protracted crisis. If the conflict is not ended, she warns it will have a spillover effect in the region, something to be avoided at all costs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on UN matters, the head of the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan says reported attacks on independent media and civil society groups in the country could affect the conduct of credible elections in 2024. But the country's spokesperson and Minister of Information says the media is not censored in South Sudan. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Juba.
Nicholas Haysom, who is also the special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says it's left to 14 months.
The UN High Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan has called on the South Sudan government to cease unlawful media censorship and intolerable restrictions on civic and political activities and halt attacks on journalists and human rights defenders as the country prepares for national elections in December 2024. In a report titled Entrenched Repression, the Systematic Curtailment of Democratic and Civic Space in South Sudan, released Thursday, the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan says the country should do more to improve shrinking media and civic space ahead of next year's elections. Barney Apeko is a member of the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan. He says that it is a tragic irony that in an independent South Sudan, its liberators now in government are intolerable of public scrutiny, discussions of critical views and political opposition.
As we've reported in the past, we've continued to find this year that the state is attacking journalists, activists, and even ordinary citizens, particularly anybody who dares to discuss issues that the authorities may deem either sensitive or to be critical of their positions. Reprisals include intimidation, harassment, violence, beatings, sexual violence against women, arbitrary detentions, and torture.
Michael McQuay, South Sudan Information Minister and government spokesperson, disputes the report and says it was ill-intended.
Personally, we don't expect the human rights, the so-called human rights here in South Sudan, to write positively one day about the government of South Sudan. So I don't agree with it. I have nothing to say other than these are people who are doing their job to be safe. This media situation in South Sudan improved a long time ago, and I have repeatedly stated, have you heard of any journalist ever arrested after Michael Isikito? And this is a clear message that we have really improved the media situation and the freedom of press, freedom of media, and freedom of speech.
Carlos Castresana is another member of the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan. He says the National Security Service, or NSS, allegedly imposes censorship in newsrooms and interferes with the activities of civil society groups. He adds that the violations could affect the credibility of next year's elections.
And then before the elections can be granted in a free environment, we need to be sure that civil society is free, that the South Sudanese society is really open, democratic, transparent, that the institutions are reliable, that the citizen can participate without risking retaliations, that the media are really free and can communicate openly the information, that the political parties can act socially with freedom, and these guarantees are not granted.
Castresana says security officers are often deployed to newsrooms, especially at the printing centers, to review content and cut stories deemed critical to the government, including coverage of political and human rights issues. Information Minister McQuay admits that security officers are deployed at newspaper printing press. He argues that the security officers are guarding against the publishing of hate speech in newspapers.
When it is a hate speech, it must be removed, because we don't want to prosecute anybody who publishes a hate speech. This is why we remove them. Otherwise, if they don't want them removed, we take action against them, because hate speech is not a right. So instead of us taking anybody to the court, we remove the speech, and that is all.
Kong Pal Chang is chairperson of the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, or AMDIS, and manager of Juba-based iRadio. He says he welcomes the report about media censorship across the country.
One of my journalists was harassed at the parliament for reporting the boycott, when the opposition boycott the sitting, the passing of the budget because of 1-2-3 issue. I'm not saying they are happening every day, but that one incident that happened last month, maybe another incident will happen next month.
The UN Human Rights Report says South Sudanese are desperate to have an accountable government that can deliver on its human rights obligations, but rushing toward elections without these key fundamentals in place could fuel further violence in the country. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Juba.
Still in Juba, the United Nations mission in South Sudan and the TRICA countries of the United States, United Kingdom and Norway have set 10 conditions for holding free and fair elections in 2024. The head of the UNMISS says South Sudan government should open up political and civic space, deploy necessary unified forces to provide security during elections, and allocate funds for independent commissions. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Nicholas Haysom, who is also the special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says it's left to 14 months to conduct elections. Speaking at a plenary meeting of the Reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMEC, earlier Thursday, Haysom says the transitional government of national unity should prepare the grounds for elections.
A conducive political and security environment, level playing field for all political parties, as well as civic and political space, are critical before, during, and after the elections. I note the preparation of a National Electoral Security Action Plan is ongoing, and encourage a multi-party approach to building confidence in this plan. These efforts are inextricably linked to finalizing the transitional security arrangements and addressing general insecurity across the country, in particular to mitigate subnational violence so as to instill confidence that the constitution-making process and elections can be conducted in a safe and secure environment.
He urged the parties to reconstitute and fund the National Constitutional Review Commission, National Elections Commission, and Political Parties Council.
What is sought by South Sudanese is not just elections, but free, fair and credible elections. In short, a level political playing field. Until the political party council is functioning, no party can properly register. As some of the parties witnessed the heightened political activity and campaigning of the SPLMIG, they are charging that the single party is being irreversibly privileged.
Elia Lumoro, South Sudan's Minister for Cabinet Affairs, says the government is reviewing the suggestions from UNMISS and the Troika.
UNMISS experts on electoral process through the government trilateral joint task force have presented to the government 10 points on elections and its challenges in order for the parties to the agreement make political decisions.
Lincoln Neyman Berryman, the Norwegian ambassador to South Sudan, who represented the Troika at the TASIS plenary meeting, says the Troika is disappointed by the lack of political will from the parties to the agreement.
Security sector reform is a prerequisite for free, fair and credible elections. We call on the parties to reach full agreement on the command structure, ensure meaningful deployment of NUF, and implement the wider chapter to security sector reforms. The Troika acknowledges the enactment of the National Elections Act establishing a legal framework for the conduct of elections. However, other major necessary milestones remain unachieved. We call on the transitional government to present a comprehensive strategy to ensure free, fair, peaceful and credible elections.
UNMISS and Troika also urge the transitional government of national unity to tackle communal violence across the country before the conduct of the 2024 elections. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a new report on South Sudan's economy points out loopholes. Find out why after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A recent report funded by the United States Department of State sheds light on South Sudanese economy, highlighting how President Salva Kiir's management since 2018 has centralized power and money among a select elite while negatively affecting the general population. Joshua Chris, the author of the report titled Payday Loans and Backroom Empires, South Sudan's political economy since 2018, has just returned from South Sudan and discusses his findings with my colleague Nabil Biagio from upstate New York.
The problem that's happened to the South Sudanese economy really since the beginning of the civil war in 2013 has been a total collapse of the payment of wages. So the government really doesn't pay wages or provide services in the country, and those wages it does provide are woefully inadequate. So I was just in Yambio and I was talking to a policeman, and that policeman earned the equivalent of $4 a month. And we went to the market together and I asked one of the butchers how much a kilo of meat costs, and he said $4 a month. So wages have not kept apace with rampant inflation, even those wages that are paid, and those wages are only paid every 2 months or every 3 months. They're always paid late. That isn't about government scarcity. That was a government decision, a tactical decision, to undermine the salaried class of government workers around the country, because it was easier for them to favor political figures through favors and through effectively giving licenses to different county commissioners in order to tax populations under their control. So we saw a shift. It's one of the major things the paper argues, from an economy in which the government provided wages to pay off the political class, to one in which it's collapsed the wage structure, leading to really general immiseration through the country, and instead supports chosen politicians and military commanders through the paying of favors or through the paying of private money directly from the office of the president. The government itself has increasingly privatized the state.
You argue in the paper that serves, while it immiserates the general population, it serves the political elite around President Kiir.
That's right, Nabil. So what's happened is, while the population has increasingly become poorer, more dependent on humanitarian aid. What Salva's tried to do, President Salva Kiir, has to keep all the power effectively to him and to a narrow coterie, a narrow group of supporters that he has within the office of the president. And so what it's actually looked like on the ground is that both money and power are more and more centralized in Juba. And the way that Juba, the way that Kiir's regime prevents the emergence of an opposition is by fragmenting and setting against each other different political forces in the rest of the country. So you get this paradoxical development where there's a bigger centralization of power and a bigger centralization of money in Salva's hands, but there's more fragmentation and more conflict in the rest of the country.
You examine three areas where you argue an elite group around President Kiir diverts resources to their benefits: oil, humanitarianism, and loans from financial institutions. Can you explain in simple terms how they do that?
For the international financial institutions, there's been a series of loans called RCF loans from the International Monetary Fund that began during COVID. Now, of those loans, only 70% of them are actually accounted for. 30% just vanished. And we're talking about each time $250 million. Even for the money that is received and accounted for, a lot of it overwhelmingly goes to Kiir's supporters rather than the opposition. So if you look at the money used to pay soldiers' salaries, it went to Division 11 and it went to divisions in Warap and in Northern Barkhazal, rather than going, for instance, to more opposition-dominated divisions such as Division 4 in Bentiu. So all of the money was selectively used to pay off government supporters, not opposition supporters, actually increasing fractures. And one of the things that money was used to pay was NSS salaries, National Security Service salaries, at a time when the NSS was actively abducting people in foreign countries, like in Kenya. So that's the International Monetary Fund. The humanitarian system is subject to diversion across the country and in all sorts of ways. So if you think about, you know, you're running a big aid agency in Juba and you have to rent a compound, who are you renting from? Almost 100% you're going to be renting from someone who has connections to the government. That money is going to Kiir's regime. Then you're going to try to get your aid supplies, your humanitarian supplies, from Juba, say, to Bentiu. At every point, you're paying checkpoints. Those checkpoints are going to SSPDF commanders or, more rarely, IO commanders. Then your aid is on the ground. Who is the aid going to be delivered to? Well, in Bentiu, it's going to be delivered to groups that are favored by Nwantiel, the governor, rather than favored by the opposition. So at every stage, humanitarian aid is diverted by the government and pressed into use to serve political purposes. And then with the oil revenue, despite multiple claims to the contrary, there's still no real payment into a single oil account. So at every stage of this process, oil money is diverted by national security, by holding companies. And this the aim of Kiir's regime is to get this money off the books, to obfuscate where it comes from, to hide where it comes from, so it can go directly into the pockets of Kiir and his associates and be used to pay off commanders and other politicians. And the biggest way that this happens is via the Oil for Foods program, the Oil for Roads program. The Oil for Roads program itself constitutes now the major source, the major expenditure of state income outside of the wage structure in the office of the president. It goes into the hands of companies linked to Kiir's associates, and then it vanishes. And often roads are not built.
That's Joshua Chris, a Sudan and South Sudan expert and author of a recent report on South Sudan's economy. In part two of this interview, he shares his insights on the implementation of the 2018 peace agreement and the forthcoming 2024 general elections. We'll also bring a reaction from the government to the findings in Joshua's report. Following the dramatic ousting of Republican Kevin McCarthy from his role as House Speaker just days after the U.S. Congress ditched provisions for further funding for Ukraine, President Joe Biden said he will be delivering a major speech to convince the American people to continue supporting Ukraine in its defense against Russia's invasion. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadi Kwasara has this report.
As Ukrainian soldiers grind through their counteroffensive, the Pentagon warned that without action from Congress, funding to support the effort against Russia's invasion could run out in months. On Wednesday, President Joe Biden said he will deliver a major speech to persuade the American people to stay the course.
I'm going to make the argument that it's overwhelmingly in the interest of the United States of America that Ukraine succeed.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre declined to provide further details on the president's speech, but acknowledged in response to VOA's question that American public support is waning.
Yeah, we see the polling and we get that. We understand. But we also believe that it is fundamentally important to our own national security as well as supporting the brave people of Ukraine to continue that support.
On Tuesday, just days after the U.S. Congress ditched provisions for further Ukraine assistance in a deal to avert a government shutdown, Republican Kevin McCarthy was ousted as House Speaker. Jim Jordan, the first Republican to publicly declare his intention to succeed McCarthy, said Wednesday he is against an aid package for Ukraine.
The most pressing issue on Americans' minds is not Ukraine. It is the border situation, and it is crime on the streets.
Other potential candidates include number two House Republican Steve Scalise and Kevin Hearn, chair of the Republican Study Committee, the largest Republican caucus in the House. House Republicans plan to meet Tuesday for a first round of internal party voting. A lapse in funding could impact Ukraine's battlefields and embolden Moscow, said Luke Coffey, a senior fellow focusing on foreign policy at the Hudson Institute.
They're very hopeful that this continued chaos stays in the United States and that there isn't any funding for Ukraine.
Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said Monday he remains confident about U.S. support. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
And that's all we prepared for you this Thursday, October 5th, 2023. We now take you to Abyei with the song Samira. I will end today's show with a group calling itself Abyei Jazz Band and the song Samira. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Vasco Valoraj, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Samira, jani, Samira, wow.